Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Instinctively, we know that our brains and our guts are connected, like when you're hungry and suddenly you're in a foul mood.
I am one of those people that, like, if I haven't eaten, I get hangry and I can't focus, and all I can think about is, like, get me a sandwich right now. I'm totally one of those people. Also, I'm eating right now, so leave me alone.
Or,
if I have an upset stomach, I'm going to be in a bad mood and annoyed and aggravated.
And it goes the other way, too. Your mood affects your stomach and digestion.
I stress eat at work, not because I'm hungry, but sort of this, like, lizard brain reaction to a difficult situation at work.
Sometimes when I feel anxious, I can feel it in my stomach. My stomach clenches up, or I can just feel, like, butterflies in my stomach.
And the thing is, I have a cast iron stomach. I can eat almost anything. So when my stomach does bother me, I know it's stress related.
How does this relationship and communication work? On this episode, we explore the deep connection between our brains and our guts. Gastroenterologist Nithin Ahuja says from mouth to anus, our gastrointestinal tract is an incredibly sophisticated processing system.
It's the sort of mechanism whose elegance, I think, reveals itself with the idea or the recognition that so often we're not aware of what it's doing.
We're not aware because the system operates pretty independently.
There are a lot of neurotransmitters that are active in the gut, in the same way that there are in the brain.
Sometimes scientists call the gut our second brain, the enteric nervous system, millions of nerve cells that line our entire digestive tract. This nervous system directs digestion independently of the brain in our heads. Despite that, our guts and brains constantly talk to each other through a complicated network of nerve cells, chemicals, and hormones. This is the gut-brain axis.
Yeah, so the gut-brain axis basically refers to the multiple communication channels that exist between the gut and the brain.
That's Emeryn Mayer. He is a gastroenterologist and neuroscientist. The main highway for the gut-brain connection is the vagus nerve,
which goes in both directions.
It stretches from the brainstem to the colon, and among other things, it sends signals related to stress, anxiety, inflammation.
Signals from the gut can reach the brain, and signals from the brain, like during stress or emotions, can reach the gut.
And then that whole system is also teeming with microbes, tiny organisms that live and work in our guts and add their own chatter into the channel.
So the microbes are just taking advantage of a very complex bidirectional communication system that connects our brain with our gut.
Many scientists believe that the gut microbiome is a factor in mental illness and could come into play in treatment.
It's certainly an active frontier in terms of research.
Research, still pretty theoretical, but some pioneers are forging ahead to see if changing their guts can actually change their minds. Liz Tung got their story, and just a note, some of what we're about to hear may gross you out.
Kerwin Juarez Ojeda lives in Peru, and he's been suffering with bipolar disorder for most of his life.
Soy peruano.
I'm Peruvian, 45 years old, married, I have 5 children, and I live in northern Peru.
He tried everything to get better, but nothing seemed to work.
I was a zombie in my own house, crying, feeling trapped. I had so many suicidal thoughts, as well as many obsessive thoughts. Things like that affected me.
Kerwin describes it as hell on earth. He couldn't work, couldn't be a father to his 5 kids.
How can I explain? When someone is depressed, when you feel that everything is wrong, it's horrible. Nothing helps you. If someone tells you you'll get better if you eat a lizard, you eat it. You may not have looked for that solution, but it was necessary.
Kruwin didn't eat a lizard, but what he ended up doing may sound worse to some people. He heard about the idea of using fecal transplants to treat mental illness, even found some how-to videos online, and he decided to try it himself, using his wife as a stool donor. Fecal transplants are still relatively new. So far, they've mostly been used to treat the difficult and sometimes deadly gut infection known as C. diff, with a cure rate of up to 90%. Traditionally, C. diff has been treated using antibiotics. But the thing is, antibiotics kill off the good bacteria in our guts along with the bad. And that's a problem because our digestive systems depend on a healthy microbiome, basically our bacterial ecosystems. You can think of it like a food processing factory. All the different microbiota are your workers, each with their own job, operating different machinery to break down and process their product. But when those good workers are wiped out, the machinery might stop working. Even worse, there's no one to defend the factory when you get bad actors like C. diff trying to take over. What fecal transplants do is replenish the workforce. Here's how it works. The donor is screened for diseases and infectious pathogens. Once cleared, they donate their stool, which is then mixed with saline for easier delivery. And then it's transferred to the recipient, usually using colonoscopy tools or an enema, or more rarely, oral capsules. But using fecal transplants to try and treat mental illness is still a totally new frontier, and not something you can just do in a hospital. I talked to one Australian psychiatrist, Russell Hinton, and he said he had a patient who, like Kruwin, had tried everything to treat her bipolar disorder.
So she had mood stabilizers, lithium, lamotrigine. She had antipsychotics, quetiapine, olanzapine. She had antidepressants, paroxetine, sertraline. She had some benzodiazepines, diazepam, oxazepam, lorazepam.
That's just some of the drugs they tried, and none of them were working. Then Russell heard about some new research linking gut ecology with mental health. These studies had found that by changing the microbiomes of mice, they could manipulate their body weight, even their mood.
And I thought, that's incredible, just thinking about that, and just thinking if you could do that for people. That's almost science fiction.
This idea totally grabbed Russell's patient. She decided she was going to do it on her own, no matter what. So he offered to supervise the process.
So, you know, while I was excited and interested, I certainly didn't want to, I guess I wasn't promoting it because the evidence just wasn't there. It certainly wasn't at that time.
The beginning was a little rocky. After all, she was starting one treatment while trying to ease off her medications. But after a while, she noticed a real improvement in her mood. Russell remembers talking with her about half a year later.
And I've noted it down here. She said, quote, "I feel like a normal person," quote.
Kruwin, the guy in Peru we heard from, also had success with his fecal transplant. He had to repeat the process several times. But still, the depression lifted. Kruwin was even able to go back to work.
Pero también no es una panacea.
It's not a panacea. We shouldn't throw out medication. Someone who's been sick for 20 years doesn't become healed overnight. But thanks to this, I'm much better.
The idea is promising enough that researchers around the world are preparing to launch clinical trials using fecal transplants to treat serious mental illness. Among them is Felice Jacka.
And I'm the director of the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University in Australia.
Felice has made a name for herself as a pioneer in the world of nutritional psychiatry, exploring the link between our guts and our mental health. For example, in 2010, she released a high-profile study drawing a link between diet and high-prevalence mental disorders like depression. One of the things she's continuing to look at is how the microbes in our gut are able to affect our brains. She emphasizes this is very complex and still evolving science, but there are a couple ideas for how microbes work their magic. The first starts with digestion.
The process itself releases vast amounts of different sorts of molecules, metabolites. And it's these metabolites that we think interact with so many parts of the systems in the body.
Those metabolites are the building blocks for neurotransmitters: dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin. Felice says they may not directly influence the brain because of the blood-brain barrier, but it's still possible they have some kind of influence. Another big way that microbes may affect mental and brain health is through our immune systems. According to Felice, as much as 70% of our immune function is a product of what happens in the gut. And that matters because
the immune system is very closely involved in mental health. Immune, what we call inflammation, which is this chronic low-grade immune activation, which is extremely common, is a risk factor for clinical depression, as well as being a consequence in many cases of depression.
Some of these ideas have been borne out in recent studies, showing how the gut affects the brain and vice versa. In mice and humans, we found the presence or lack of specific microbiota to be connected with everything from depression to fibromyalgia to autism. I talked with one researcher, Giulio Licinio, who found that schizophrenia, or at least schizophrenic-like symptoms, actually seem to be transferable using gut microbes.
If you put in those germ-free mice microbes from people with schizophrenia, their behavior becomes more erratic.
And that finding was a big deal, because it adds one more piece of evidence that there is causality there, that our microbiomes don't just reflect mental illness, but could actually be causing mental illness. So I asked Giulio if he thinks it's possible that there's like a mental illness microbe. And here's what he said.
Do you know, it's a big question in the field. And I know other groups who are working with bipolar disorder that seems to be something like this too, or even in depression. But there is a possibility that there are some microbes that are very specific to mental illness. It would be a huge finding if that's confirmed. So we are still being a little cautious because, you know, we don't want to, you know, say, oh, this is the biggest breakthrough and it's not proven yet. But it seems to be the case that there are at least some microbes that are very specific to people with mental illness.
Which led me to one final question. If the gut microbiome really plays a role in mental illness, what's the original causality? What creates the changes that mess with our guts and ultimately our brains? Gastroenterologist and neuroscientist Emeryn Meyer has an idea. He says we've seen an exponential rise in lots of diseases. Autism, autoimmune diseases, depression, anxiety.
It's always been thought that there is a microbial basis to that because our lifestyles, our nutrition have changed dramatically over the last 60 years, which had an effect on the diversity of our gut microbiome. So it's estimated that approximately a 40% loss of diversity over the last, since World War II.
So scientists think diet has likely played a role. And then there are other factors. Take, for example, the Australian woman that psychiatrist Russell Hinton treated. He says she has an idea about what may have started her bipolar illness.
She reports becoming sick as a teenager. This was quite a long time before I met her, after taking about 10 courses of antibiotics over a two-year period to treat tonsillitis.
Now, we can't know if that's what actually kicked off the illness. But a large-scale study from earlier this year found that childhood infections leading to hospitalization, and especially antibiotic use, were associated with an increased risk of mental disorders later in life. Of course, the positive part of this whole theory is that microbiomes are changeable, at least to an extent. Russell says for him, this experience has led him to focus a lot more on his patients' diets. These days, he's more likely to warn against carbs, processed foods, and sugar, and to extol the virtues of veggies and high-fiber foods. As for fecal transplants, he's not recommending them yet, but he hopes they might be an option soon.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. One of the researchers Liz interviewed for her story, Felice Jacka, is launching a clinical trial to study fecal transplants. We're talking about the connection between our guts and our brains, right now focusing on digestion and mental health issues. For some people with eating disorders, food and mental health are connected in more ways than one. Restricting food becomes a proxy of sorts in managing anxiety and depression. Food and eating become associated with failure, shame, and guilt. And often diet options become more and more limited.
In the worst of my disordered eating, I was eating the same thing every day for almost 2 years straight.
That's Morgan Dykeman. She ate the same thing for breakfast.
Berry smoothie that was frozen berries and water.
Lunch.
Romaine with lemon juice.
And dinner.
Sautéed kale and a salmon filet.
For 2 years.
Berry smoothie that was frozen
romaine with lemon juice.
Kale and a salmon filet.
Berry smoothie that was romaine with lemon juice.
Sautéed kale and a salmon.
Sautéed kale and a salmon
kale
filet.
And a salmon filet.
Morgan started dieting when she was 12, and her daily regimen was designed to stay under 500 calories. And were you just starving all the time? I mean, you must have been so hungry.
Yeah, I was starving all the time and be hungry through the entire day. But I, over time, had learned to associate that empty growling feeling that you get in your belly with success, that I was doing the right thing, that this meant I would be skinny soon and everyone would know it. That's what the empty feeling meant.
Low carb or no carb diets were already popular, and pasta and bread were absolute no-nos for Morgan. If she slipped,
I would feel racked with a lot of guilt and shame. I had a really clear internal compass about what food was good and what food was bad, and straying from the good path felt incredibly shameful. Super guilty.
How did you feel during this time, emotionally and on a gut level?
Emotionally, I was so sad. I was really sad and tired all the time because I was severely underfed. So I emotionally was feeling super slow and didn't have a lot of energy to do anything that I liked. And I think on a gut level, gosh, this is gross, but I did not have a solid bowel movement for that entire 2 years.
Eventually, Morgan got help from a therapist and dietitian, and her body and mind had to relearn to be comfortable with all the foods she had avoided for so long.
I remember specifically one instance with my dietitian where she brought in different breads and we sat them out and tried to figure out exactly what about the bread I didn't like, or if it was the idea of bread as a bad food within the confines of the diets that I was on.
So what did you realize about the bread? What were you thinking?
Well, at first I was terrified, so scared. It really embodied all the things I thought that I needed to avoid to be worthy of love and attention from anyone else and myself. So I really didn't want to eat any of the bread, so we first spent time just touching it, seeing if it was the texture that I didn't like, just feeling it, and then taking small bites.
So as you're eating it, how is your stomach reacting?
Yeah, so my stomach did not know what to do. After the way my dietitian described it to me was that your intestines are like muscles, and they get toned by digesting food over time. And the same way, if you didn't lift heavy objects, your arms would lose their tone. My intestines had lost their tone. And so I could not really digest it. It led to a lot of stomach pain and being backed up, which I wasn't expecting. And I just had to like reteach my digestive system how to eat these foods that I had been depriving myself of.
When your stomach was feeling bad after you ate bread, would you then also feel bad in terms of your mental health? Now having eaten the bread, now I'm feeling sick.
Oh, yeah. You know.
So what would happen there?
It came to feel like there was a devil on my shoulder. That was the voice of this eating disorder telling me, oh, you're sick now because you ate this bad food and you are weak, you are powerless, and now you'll never reach your goals because people who eat bread are failures. Like, it sounds ridiculous when I say it now, but really I believed it for a long time. And I think a lot of people caught up in fad dieting also internalized some of that good, bad dichotomy.
How do you eat now? What's on your plate? What's in your lunch?
Now I'm really excited to follow my hunger and listen to what my body is craving. As opposed to the devil on my shoulder telling me what not to eat, I listen to what my gut is telling me it wants. So I eat a really wide variety of foods.
And how's your stomach?
Oh, it's fine. It doesn't bother me at all. Everything is super normal.
Morgan Dykman lives in Bellingham, Washington. You can read some of her essays at morgantic.com. Imagine you're feeling nauseous all the time and you can barely eat. And doctors are totally perplexed. This happens to a lot of people who suffer from a mysterious but very common syndrome. Alan Yu reports, and we're only using first names for patients in the story to protect their privacy.
The sensation would come out of nowhere.
I'd be on a plane, a train, or at work, and I would have these feelings that, for me, I just thought that I was very, very dizzy, and that I ate something, and I was almost having vertigo.
Robin was in her 20s and traveling a lot for work.
And then I would either feel like I had to throw up or go to the bathroom. And it was like a sense of urgency of like, right now.
Robin would panic, and that would make her even more sick. She realized it had something to do with food, but what food? What was going on? During this time, she was going through fertility treatments, and the vast majority of what she ate did not agree with her.
It got to the point where I could like really barely eat food. There was like maybe three things that I could safely eat and not get sick. One makes sense, toast. The other were bananas. And the third were plain McDonald's hamburgers.
Welcome to McDowell's. May I take your order?
I guess because McDonald's is almost a non-food item, right? So if I could get one hamburger in me a week, I feel like I would get some level of protein. Every once in a while, I'd be able to eat like a piece of banana bread or something like that, that I would try to, you know, pack some protein, like some peanut butter powder or something into.
So that's all she could eat. She lost 20 pounds. Robin wanted to figure out what was going on with her. She went to doctors and got test after test for vertigo, cancers, thyroid, gallbladder, food allergies.
This one blood panel that I got, I thought I was, you know, I was like, am I going to have any blood left by the time they went through all the different tests, where they tested for so many individual foods like avocado, green peppers, tomatoes, dairy, all these like specific foods to see if I had an actual allergy.
She did not. Still sick though. Some of the doctors just told her there's nothing wrong. Of course, she knew that wasn't true if she had to live on a diet of hamburgers, toast, and bananas.
I had to spend a lot of time advocating for myself that something was wrong, that I was sick. Because the primary care doctors would say, well, we ran these tests and like nothing's come back.
But eventually, the doctors settled on something.
And like, yeah, we'll call it IBS because that's kind of this catch-all, almost like it's not a real thing.
IBS stands for Irritable Bowel Syndrome. Doctors have described these symptoms as early as the 19th century, but it wasn't until the 1940s that two researchers used the phrase irritable bowel syndrome. Robin first got this diagnosis 14 years ago, and back then it really was kind of a catch-all term. If a patient had diarrhea, constipation, just an assortment of bowel problems that doctors couldn't explain otherwise, they would call it IBS. It was less of a precise diagnosis, and more of a different way to say, we don't know what's going on. Robin went to a gastrointestinal specialist, and even he didn't believe her. And when Robin got sick, dizziness, nausea, and urge to go to the bathroom, people around her didn't know what to do either.
95% of the times that I got sick and had to say something to someone of like, hey, I'm really sick, is I actually told them I was pregnant. Because it's a lot easier to explain to someone, oh, I'm dizzy, I feel nauseous, I feel whatever, you know, is that you're pregnant.
One time she got very sick at a grocery store and another woman got worried.
And I ended up, you know, kind of pulling myself through it. But I told the woman that I was pregnant and then I saw her at the grocery store again. So, of course, then she's like, oh, you were pregnant, right? You were really sick. So like now this is an awkward follow-up conversation.
But Robin had to tell her something, so...
I went for the even more terrible route where I told her I had a miscarriage.
Which she really had experienced several times.
Think about how terrible it is that it was more comfortable for me to tell someone that I had a miscarriage than to say I had IBS.
people know what being pregnant or having a miscarriage means. But telling strangers she had IBS could just lead to questions that even researchers don't have answers for. Robin's experience, painful as it was, is not unique. Around 12% of people in North America are estimated to have IBS, and a lot of IBS patients share Robin's bad experiences with doctors.
People have been either dismissed, saying that it's all in your head and it's nothing wrong with you, or they've been dismissed as saying, you know, there's nothing wrong, so we just call it IBS. Both of which are false.
Poona Kashyap is an expert in gastroenterology at the Mayo Clinic. He says the problem is the way that IBS works kind of defies our usual model of medicine.
Our traditional medicine is based on the fact that you do a test, it comes back positive, you make a diagnosis, and you treat it, right? So there is something in addition to what the patient tells you, there's a test to substantiate it.
But there's no test for IBS, no score that we can focus on. It doesn't help that we don't know what exactly causes IBS. We know what the symptoms are, but they can vary from patient to patient. William Che is a professor of gastroenterology at the University of Michigan. He says the current thought is that patients with IBS are particularly sensitive to food, stress, and anxiety, and that leads to an exaggerated response from the gut.
You know, I think the way many healthcare providers and the healthcare system in general views it is, yes, it's a bothersome condition, but it's not a serious condition. Let's be frank, it doesn't hold the same gravity or weight on either a social or scientific level as, for example, cancer.
People don't die from it, and it doesn't get as much research funding from the National Institutes of Health, but it does affect people's quality of life.
A story that I hear very often from my IBS patients is I'm literally not able to leave my home. I can't tell you how many IBS patients, for example, never go out to eat at a restaurant.
2 years ago, one of the several primary care doctors Robin had seen told her maybe she needed an anti-anxiety medication, because clearly this is giving her a lot of stress, and it's not like anything else is helping. She also tried a highly restrictive diet for people with IBS, which means she has to avoid eating a lot of things. Fruits, honey, dairy, wheat, onion, garlic, beans, lentils, soy, sweeteners, and more. Those two things, diet and anti-anxiety medication, help her manage IBS. She's now a CEO and has a 3.5-year-old son she adopted.
And I look back now, I'm like, oh my gosh, I was so sick. I was so sick. And I just had to like keep picking myself up and going to work and moving my life forward. But it was really, really hard.
She says the key to treating her symptoms, the thing that her doctors had missed for years and years, was that her stress and anxiety and her gut problems were connected. Scientists writing about IBS have referred to the connection between the brain and the gut as far back as the early 2000s, but they have since made a lot more progress. William Che says we now know that for people with IBS, stress and anxiety that starts in the brain can lead to this overreaction in the gut.
So that one experiences pain or diarrhea or constipation.
But the problems could also start in the gut. Gut problems could lead to anxiety and mood changes. The gut can function on its own. It has nerves. Some researchers call it a second brain.
You can disconnect the big brain in the head from the GI tract, and most of the functions will go on their own.
And that's the principle behind one of the treatments for IBS aside from diet and medication, a treatment that scientists have studied as early as the 1980s, gut-directed hypnosis.
Comfortable pillows and chairs, but there are not pocket watches anywhere.
Lindsay McKernan is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. She studies and treats people who have chronic pain and IBS with clinical hypnosis. If IBS is due to a patient's gut being oversensitive, then gut-directed hypnosis will focus someone's attention on their gut, tell it to relax. First, Lindsay works with a patient to find a safe place that they'd like to travel to in their mind.
That place of safety can really range from a person sitting in a chair in their own living room to being on the beach or being in the forest, or actually being at the gym for some people. It's really just a somewhere that you feel completely comfortable and in control.
The patient should be relaxed. They could sit, lie on the floor, eyes closed, eyes open, whatever works for them. By the way, this is not meant to teach you how to do hypnosis, so don't try this on your own. So let's say the gym is your safe place.
So looking around and looking at what you can see in the gym, starting to elicit those sensations of what you can feel as you're in the gym. It could be lifting weights or working on a heavy bag or even sitting down where your body would feel more comfortable and relaxed. And then letting me know when you're there. And that's when suggestions begin. I might say, and now that you're here, I wonder in what ways that your mind can help you feel more comfortable. It may be that your mind, anytime you feel discomfort, allows your body to produce a sensation of cooling blue liquid beginning at the top of your neck, moving down the body and wrapping around the abdomen, removing any areas of discomfort, helping you feel more and more comfortable as it moves and wraps around.
Lindsay will guide an IBS patient into that soothing state for 20 to 40 minutes during a session. The goal is for them to do it themselves, wherever and whenever they feel stressed or uncomfortable. Think of it like a mental Pepto-Bismol.
You know, if someone likes going to the beach, but they're stuck in a landlocked state like Tennessee, it could be really helpful to feel like you're there and feel as comfortable as you do when you're sitting in front of the beach and watching the waves in a moment's notice while you're sitting in the car line waiting for your kids at the end of the day.
Research and patient testimony shows this really does work for some people. Hypnosis is now an accepted treatment for IBS. There are professional standards and training for how it's done. Insurance will pay for it, including Medicare and a few state Medicaid programs. Remember Robin from the start of our story? The landscape around IBS has changed since she first got her diagnosis more than a decade ago. For instance, some magazines now label their recipes to tell people with IBS whether they work with the extremely restrictive diet.
And they had a little stamp on it, just like you would see, you know, the GF for gluten-free. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, could we get to that place?
But we still don't know a lot about what causes IBS, and patients can have vastly different experiences.
So I'd say to anyone who is suffering with what has been diagnosed or not with IBS or a digestive disorder, it's really isolating and it's really important to let people know about it and to ask for help.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. It's frustrating to have a severe condition like irritable bowel syndrome and not to understand what's driving the inflammation or causing the symptoms. The thing is, when it comes to gut function, there are so many things we don't yet understand. Take, for example, enteroendocrine cells. This is a type of cell that's found in your gut.
Which is like an antenna. So it sticks its little fingers into your gut, and it senses what's going on around it. And so it can control things like how much water you keep in your system. Are you hungry? It sends these messages that you need to digest your food.
But how these cells are sending signals or what triggers them remains unknown. Abigail Kappas is trying to get a better handle on those types of questions. She is an assistant professor of chemical engineering at Northeastern University in Boston.
We want to try to get out of doing animal studies and studies on people, which are very complex, costly, time-consuming.
Instead, her lab is creating little research platforms with human cells,
which we call organ-on-chips or microphysiological systems that mimic some of the physiology of people and animals so that we can then simplify the system to enable us to control the environment, to ask very tight scientific questions that might be muddied in the more complex sort of human environment.
So if I'm probably way oversimplifying this here, but are you basically trying to recreate something that resembles a human gut on a chip so that you can study stuff in it?
That's exactly correct. So we're trying to take some of the cell types that are found in our own body, the cells that sort of make up the layer or the epithelial cells, which are the cells that absorb nutrients and drugs in your gut. If we take those cells and we take cells from the nervous system that would then be relaying the information between the two, and we put them alone in a system, we can study how they talk to each other. which is really difficult in the body because you have thousands of other cells. You have the bacterial component, you have food, you have different types of responses that your body might have, and the immune component is there. And there's just so many different players that it's hard to identify in a human what the real important factors are. And so we think by sort of taking a bottom-up approach, we can look at these two cells interacting together, and then we can make it four cell types, then we can make it six cell types. And you can kind of build up the platform and understand the role that each cell type has in the system.
So if you think about your small intestine, 22 feet long when it's all stretched out, and all the things that could happen in there along the way, Abigail's chips are much more manageable.
I think they're pretty adorable. You can hold them in your hand. They look like little kind of glass microscope slides. If you think about like the microscope slides from, you know, biology class, or you're looking at different samples under a microscope, they're similar in size to those.
So one day, fast forward 20 years or 50 years, what do you hope we'll be able to do?
Sure. In 20 or 50 years, I hope that these technologies are sort of available in, you know, more clinical settings, so that you'd hope that someone would be able to, you know, go in and say, you know, my stomach hurts, or I have this other issue with my nervous system and we don't know what it is. And perhaps this could be one diagnostic. So you could take a biopsy from a person. Then you could do these different tests almost right there in the, you know, clinical setting at the site of where the doctors are making their decisions.
Abigail Kappes is an assistant professor of chemical engineering at Northeastern University in Boston. Joseph Fridman helped produce this segment. Coming up, when an important part of your digestive system gives up the ghost.
I don't want to jump to surgery, so let's try to make some diet changes, all right? Well, what kind of diet changes?
That's still to come on The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the connection between our guts and our brains. Millions of Americans have gut health issues. For example, persistent constipation. And maybe part of the problem is our attitude toward gut function. Anything related to it, the smells, the noises, is considered embarrassing. Keep it to yourself. Not so in South Korea. Reporter Matthew Schneeman used to live there, and he has this story.
When I used to live in Jeju, a South Korean island just south of the mainland, one of the first things I noticed was how people talked about poop. It's called dong in Korean. They talked about it in both silly ways, like the game of dongchim, which translates to poop needle, where kids poke each other in the butt. But poop was also taken seriously, like friends talking about constipation. There's a poop-themed cafe in Seoul, and poop sculptures scattered throughout the country. My friend Daryl Coote and his wife, Hyun Jung Lim, live in Jeju. They recently had a baby.
Hey, can you hear us okay?
Yeah.
I'm Hyun Jung.
Yeah, we have the baby. We've tried to sedate her with snacks, so hopefully she won't interrupt.
The baby, Aurora, was present. And that was quite fitting. Perhaps this is where the casual approach to poop in South Korea starts. Hyun Jung noted the difference between her Canadian in-laws and her Korean parents in regards to Aurora's poop.
I think, like, your parents were here. If, like, Aurora farts, I think your parents didn't react to anything.
Okay.
But my parents, if she farts, she makes, like, oh, boom, boom. They make the noise and laugh.
Hyun Jung told me about mom's cafes, which are internet groups where moms post pictures of their baby's poop.
Are you a part of these groups?
No, but it's not uncommon in Korea. Uh-huh. They took a picture of baby's dong, and if like it's normal or whatever, they put on the internet and ask about it. Or dog dong.
Did you have a dog dong too?
And this poop positive attitudes continues past childhood. Korean-American journalist Michelle Ngo says her mom raised her to be conscious of her stool. And sometimes Michelle finds this cultural difference hard to navigate.
I don't know. I just find it weird. Like, Americans talk about their dating lives with their parents as if that's normal. To me, that's not normal at all. But talking about pooping and, like, how big was your poop this morning, like, that's very normal to me. And, like, that comes more naturally than telling my mom about who I'm dating, which I've done maybe twice in my life, you know?
Michelle says thinking about digestion and poop is almost subconscious. It's something that's constantly running through your mind when you make decisions about food.
It's sort of how people track calories, you know? I think Koreans track the poop factor of each food. Everything you eat, you'll sort of think about it.
Michelle's mom checks in on her regularly. She gives advice about size, shape, and texture of the poop.
Yeah, the little, like, the rabbit poop, that's very unhealthy. That's not good. Like, you're really stressed out. My mom would say, like, you're probably really anxious. You got to relax. Here, have some kimchi, you know? You know, what you really want is, like, a solid, like, fist-sized poop that comes out in, like, one go. Like, that's, you are peak healthy. My mom would be very proud. Like, I would, if I pooped a poop like that, I would literally call my mom and tell her. Like, I would be super proud of that.
That story was reported by Matthew Schneeman. We're talking about the connection between our guts and our brains. When Alexander Charles Adams started having serious issues with nausea and vomiting, it led to a spiral of anxiety and depression. Eventually, Alexander's doctors figured out what was going on, and it was not at all what they'd expected. Again, this story may be a little bit gross for some listeners.
When it started, it was only once a month. But then it was once a week, twice a week, and then almost every day, right when I wake up, I think I'm going to vomit. The nausea will wake me up at 5 or 4 in the morning, and I have seconds to act before. I started to write down when it was happening more and more. I marked it in my iCal under had vomiting as an all-day event.
Okay. Had vomiting. All right, let's see. July 4th, June 24th, June 19th, June 15th, June 14th, June 6th.
These are just the days I threw up, not every day where I felt like someone was microwaving my stomach the second I woke up. Just to cover it, these aren't hangovers, I don't drink, and I am not lactose intolerant. Even with these episodes, I felt too busy, stressed, and depressed to seek medical attention. Until this May. The turning point was on the road to work, right before the interstate. I was vomiting clear and yellow bile out of my car window at the red light. I was so embarrassed and hoped no one was looking at me. So I finally got an appointment with a GI specialist. We started with a battery of tests.
Ultrasounds, blood tests,
stool samples,
x-rays,
stomach emptying studies,
more blood tests.
It was like I was giving blood twice a week for a hot minute. I went back to my GI for a follow-up, and they found I had elevated enzymes for pancreatic distress. Suddenly, I was discussing pancreatic and stomach cancer risk. My next steps were going to be more expensive tests that I had no idea how I was going to cover. I'll jump to the results, which took 2 weeks for me to get. I did not have cancer, not in my stomach or my pancreas. There were no abnormalities found in any of the scans I took. And of course I cried. Hard. But I had to pull it back together to understand what was going to happen next. It was the last test we scheduled in this whole saga. A HIDA scan. H-I-D-A. It's an IV test where contrast is pumped in, making your gallbladder contract, and they take pictures of it to see how well it functions. The test is an hour, and the contrast releases every 10 minutes. The last 5 minutes are continuous release. It's supposed to be painless or a little uncomfortable. The technician signaled that the first release would begin, and then... It felt like someone was grabbing through my stomach to reach my throat. Then it would stop. And it dawned on me, this is gonna happen 6 more times. Oh God. Then it's gonna happen for 5 minutes. By the end, I was having major spasms and wanted so bad to vomit, honestly, but I physically couldn't. I just felt sick. The test showed that my gallbladder had spontaneously failed and had no gallstones. We don't know why. I went to talk to my GI about next steps, and she said, well, I don't want to jump to surgery, so let's try to make some diet changes, all right? Well, what kind of diet changes? Well, you can't process fats almost at all anymore. So, so it's fats. The thing causing all of that vomiting and distress is beautiful, delicious, commonplace fats. In this story, pain is French fries leaving the body. Since finding out, following a fat-free diet is very hard. Truly, it is difficult based on where I live, how much money I have, and the time I can dedicate to preparing food. Also, y'all, French fries are just good. But I have a sweet prescription for the nausea now. I always have my water and pills set out before I go to bed. I wake up and I don't try to bargain with myself about not needing the meds or that I can sleep off the sick feeling. I sit up, take the pills, drink the water, and then meditate on Baby, You're a Trip by Prince until I get that sweet, sweet release. I'm not sure what will happen next, and my situation may suddenly change again. Will I need to have my gallbladder removed? Or will I just live fat-free forever? I don't know, but I'm gonna be okay.
That was Alexander Charles Adams. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Grant Hill is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.